This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik. Last year, the National Cancer Council Malaysia, or MACNA, was one of the recipients of the esteemed Merdeka Award, and they received it under the Education and Community category. So today I'll be speaking to Puan Farhida Mohamad Farid, General Manager of MACNA, to find out more about how the organisation has been supporting cancer patients in Malaysia for over 26 years. How are you today, Farah?
Hi, I'm fine, thank you. Under the circumstances, I'm good.
Under the circumstances, of course. Everybody is facing very, very challenging circumstances, you know, for the whole of 2020. And looking ahead at 2021, we've still got quite a lot of hurdles in front of us. But, you know, 2020 must have had that bright spot for MACNA, on receiving the Merdeka Award. Maybe just, you know, if you can share with us, how did you feel upon receiving it?
Great, thanks. I mean, with any award, the first thing is like, oh, okay, what? sheer surprise, but, you know, humility as well. You know, what we do, we don't do work for recognition. We do for the passion, for the love of what we do. And this is the third sector, and this is a sector that people who have a passion to help someone else. So. So the award was just an icing on the cake.
And like I said, 2020 was a difficult year for everyone. What was it like for MACNA? What kinds of challenges did the pandemic, or has the pandemic, presented to your work?
It's a very good question. We've been asking ourselves that too. but the first thing when it happened, the lockdown was, I think, in March. It was like, okay, let's get gather everybody together, the management team, to say, like, look, work cannot stop. Our patients are the ones who are going to get hit the most. If you're in lockdown, that means you can't have access to food, let alone get access to the treatment that you need. So that was one of the things that we did, was trying to say, like, look, first of all, do they have enough food? So health was number two. So we'd ensured that the food aid was given out to all our patients. So we needed to call them and find out their state of being and how they were. So that was one of the challenges. And the other one was those who already had scheduled treatments, we needed to know how they, whether it was, how mobile they were, what kind of challenges that they need to go through. For example, we had the MKN, we had the SOPs that were coming in, because at the time we didn't know what to expect. Social distancing was totally new. To educate, you know, our patients or the patients who are recipients of our program was a bit of a challenge, because they're everywhere. They're in Sabah, Sarawak, remote parts of Malaysia. So that was a huge challenge, just to get in touch with them, to call them, to find out. But yes, that was the first thing that we did. That was the first biggest hurdle that we had, just to ensure that everybody was okay.
And were you able to provide that aid for everyone who needed it?
Alhamdulillah, yes, we did. Because over the years, we've developed a relationship with Post Malaysia. And we also developed a new relationship with Aeon Big. So we got in touch with them to say, like, look, these are the items, the food that we need, the value. And Post Malaysia was on hand to deliver door to door, because they had already done that with all the, before the pandemic, they sent milk for our patients, those who couldn't, who are not mobile. They sent breast prostheses, you know, things that patients need. So with this, it was more of like getting the numbers, whereas with the earlier one, it was more of like staggered. But this was like, okay, it was like a bulk order to be sent, because it was, you know, it was just, you know, rice and stuff like that to be sent. Yes, all the patients received not all at the same time, but they did receive. And we got calls from them. We got pictures from Post Malaysia as well to say, like, look, even in Lahad Datu, semua dah dapat.
How bad was the problem? How many of your patients were lacking such essential necessities?
You see, dear, our patients are below B40. You know, they're either not earning any income. And then when the pandemic hit, it was worse. Yeah. The issue has always been bad. but this, for us, this allowed us to just not help them with food. With the medical equipment that they needed. We helped them with the survival. So we put on our humanitarian aid in place. So that was a huge opportunity. Mm. And it allowed us to go beyond our normal scope of help. So usually it's just, okay, for cancer, for treatment, traveling, you know, everything related to the disease. But when the pandemic hit, it wasn't just about the disease. It was about the survival, you know, having food, milk for the kids, Pampers for the kids. So I think there were two things. Yeah, one, our patients remote, jauh, memang jauh from civilization, how to get aid to them. So we are limited by the fact that we're in Semenanjung. We couldn't go to them, right? So we had to mobilize, you know, people on the ground, which was Post Malaysia or our volunteers. So we could mobilize them very quickly to say, like, look, these are the patients in your area. These are the things that they need right now. At least, you know, 2-3 days, and please have it, you know, sent out to them.
Okay, that's really amazing. But take us back, Farah, to how Makna began back in 1994. How did it get set up in the first place?
Everything starts with the beginning, right? It was a family's ordeal with cancer back in 1991. My brother had cancer. He had acute myeloid leukemia. And so at the time, very limited treatment was available in the country. It was a shock to the family. First thing was like, okay, we knew that if you have cancer, you're going to die. It was a death sentence, you know, at the time, right? So when my father had access, because he was a deputy minister of health, he had access to the best specialists, best treatment facilities, not just in Malaysia, but in the world. The opportunity was there for him to get treated in London. But at the time, how many people can afford to go to London to get treatment? It was for one whole year. It wasn't just a treatment cost, it was also living cost. You can't send my brother on his own. He was only 16. I was there at the time doing my final year, but, you know, I was in Nottingham. I wasn't in London. So that happened. But when he was given his transplant, his autologous transplant, that means his bone marrow was used to cure him. So at the time, it was a novel treatment, right? It was new. It was breakthrough. So he was one of the few lucky ones who could get it. But when the day of that transplant, the whole family just said, like, look, it was a realization. Who else can afford to get this kind of opportunity? Mm-hmm. Are they just going to say, like, look, I have cancer, I'm going to die, and that's it? So it was a vow, it was a pledge of the family. You know, it didn't take us long to say, like, look, when we come back, when Farrell is well, or when we come back, whatever it is, we have to give back to Malaysia, to the society. So it just started. It was just that simple reason. Mm. And when we came back, and Farrell was given the Green Bill of Health, and we started Magna.
And what did Magna start off doing in those early days?
First thing we knew when we had that discussion with the specialists, and we had a roundtable discussion with the oncologists, with the hematologists, you know, all the players in the cancer field. They said, like, look, what is it that the country needs? So it started with, look, let's just do leukemia. and see how that goes. But then there was an oncologist is like, look, why limit to one aspect of the disease? You know, why don't we just go through, you know, cancer? Cancer has like 210 under its
umbrella
scope. Mm-hmm. Why don't we do that? I think because maybe at the time they saw that, you know, my dad was in a position to do bigger things. So they said, like, look, why don't we set up, you know, a cancer organization rather than a leukemia society? Mm. That was one. And we needed to find out what was the need, what was the lacking, what was the gap? Well, the gap was default. A lot of patients come in late, one. Two, they present themselves at third and fourth stage. So chances of a cure was less than 30%. So if you come early, chances of a cure is more than 70, 80%. So what did that mean? That means, okay, we've had to find out why did they default? Why did they come late to the hospital? Why were they diagnosed so late? One of the things that we found out is because of accessibility. They didn't have money to come to the hospital. Mm. There wasn't enough centers to screen people. So that's one of the things that we did. We said, like, look, we need to address this gap. We need to raise funds to make sure that we give these people the transport costs. So it started with that. It was so simple. And it just grew from that. So we started with one patient, and now we've helped more than 100,000 patients.
So one of the key, very essential, but very key things, pay for their transportation to go to a hospital. How about the actual screening cost as well as all the other medical costs? Do you cover that as well?
That came later. That came later. That came, I think that was in 2011 when we started with our mammogram screening program, okay? But the idea was, it started in 2007. But with the financial aid, we needed to ensure that they come, they have the funds, they have the resources to come, and it was uninterrupted. That was important. We didn't want to just give one off. We needed to give, you know, to ensure that it is uninterrupted. That means we will give up to as and when that you need for the whole of your treatment. So if you need to come in a year, twice a year, we'll do that for you. If you need to come six times a year, we'll help you with that. And if you need follow-up for the next year, we will help you with that. So we have a system in place. It's all online now. It used to be, you know, paper, okay? Mm-hmm. Now we've developed the system because of the volume, and we want it to be you know, a bit more efficient so that the help would be faster to the patients. So coming back to your question about the screening, yes, we realized from 1996 up to 2007, you know, the number of cases was still third and fourth stage. You know, one and two was not, the graph wasn't much change. So we said, like, look, we need to do something about this. We need to detect people earlier. Even though we were doing a lot of cancer awareness programs, but we said, like, look, if people can't come, let's go to them. So we built a trailer, 40-foot trailer. So it goes around the country. We've built our third, this is our third trailer already. So it will reach Sabah, sorry. It's already reached Sarawak, one coming up to go to Sabah. We're planning to have it sent over by ship. Yeah, two more units are being built at the moment, so we hope that would also be ready by April.
But this, I would say, Farah, the graph hasn't changed even today. People are still coming in, being diagnosed at the late stages. What's going wrong?
Yeah, well, the national statistics, the data again. Yeah, okay. There is a change, the education, maybe not that much, but because of mindset and because of fear or denial, it's just human beings, the tools are there, but whether people still want to come forth to do it. But yes, I understand what you're saying. There were many, many programs, to show that the pickup rate was very low, right?
Mm.
That's what you're saying, isn't it? So in Malaysia, I think it's a cultural thing. It's a herd mentality, I guess. I don't know, or a community mentality, kata adik-beradik, dia baru nak pergi.
Mm-hmm.
Baru there's an urgency to go. But if it's like the proximity is not there, tak apalah. That attitude, laid back. It's a very Asian culture thing.
Mm-hmm.
Very tak apa. And this is generational. So it's behavior. So I think we need to have, behaviorists, psychologists to handle this bit, which we don't have at the moment, mm-hmm. whether it's at the national level or at NGO punya level.
Mm-hmm.
I think the psyche tu penting. Okay,
yeah.
If we go to the first world country, like Australia lah kan, or in England or Japan, it's part of the norm already. It's a population screening. It's like, going to the dentist. Every 6 months, kena pergi. Tak payah fikir. But with kat Malaysia, if you go to the dentist pun, it's not a behavior thing.
Exactly.
So with that simple thing, not go to diseases like this. So it's a challenge there.
Mm.
And I think the facilities, the resources are there. We have enough centers, and I think we have enough organizations that can help and guide you where to go. It's not the onus, it's on the individual.
Mm, yep. We'll go for a quick break. And when we come back, let's continue talking about what else Magna provides to help cancer patients in need. I understand you also have a cancer center in collaboration with HUKM. You also have halfway houses. So let's go into that a little bit. When we come back, I'm speaking to Farahida Muhammad Farid, General Manager of the National Cancer Council Malaysia, or Magna. Stay tuned, we'll be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. Joining me via Zoom today is Farahida Muhammad Farid, General Manager of the National Cancer Council Malaysia, MACNA. We're speaking to Farah, to catch up with her on what MACNA has been doing to support cancer patients in Malaysia for, over 26 years now, since Dato' Farid Arifin began this organization all those years ago. Last year, MACNA was recognized with a Merdeka Award under the Education and Community category for all the work that they've done. And it's really impressive. Farah, you spoke about going beyond supporting cancer care and treatment itself. For the pandemic, you made sure that your patients received basic food aid, and you took care of their survival first, which really in these times, that's the most important thing to look at. You've spoken about starting off by providing financial assistance for cancer patients back in the day. And this began with something as basic as covering their transportation costs so that they could go to the hospital to get screening and then, follow on with the diagnosis and their treatment journey. Can we talk about some of your other main program areas that you're doing today?
Right. I think the other things that... The gap that we saw way back in 1999 was also to have a comprehensive cancer center before Institute Cancer Negara was set up, was built, yeah? So we collaborated with HUKM at the time, and they built a 10-story hospital, and they needed someone, a partner, to handle the oncology ward. So at the time, we were thinking of setting up our own, but it was supposed to be in Janda Bait in Pahang, which was really at the time, in the 90s, accessibility, the roads were not as good as it is now. So when the proposal came from UKM, we said, look, okay, it wasn't even a month before we said, okay, let's just do it. So the ward, we co-manage with HUKM. So that started way back in 1999. So that helped with helping the country set up a cancer treatment center. So it was a collaboration of two organizations that felt that, you know, that's what the country needed at the time. And it has been going. It's been, I think, nearly 21, 22 years already, this partnership. Mm-hmm. And it's been working great. We've helped, I think, more than 50,000 patients that's gone into the ward. It's just not the oncology ward. We've got the bone marrow ward. Now it's called the stem cell ward and the radiotherapy services. So that's another way of us, you know, helping the government or a government body. So it was a synergistic, you know, alliance. You know, it fit, you know, what we needed to do as an organization, and it helped areas where that the government needed, you know.
And who are the patients who are able to access the services in this cancer center?
Because it's a government, it's run by HUKM, so it's Government Ministry of Education. So it's a referral center anyway, so it's to the public.
Okay.
But it doesn't go to us. It's a mission. It's not by us. That was under the agreement. It has to be under HUKM. So the management of admissions is by HUKM.
All right. And I understand you also run halfway houses. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. You notice as we go along in this interview, it was just, okay, gap, fill it up. Gap, fill it. Gap, fill it. So that has been the spectrum of our journey. Because at that time, this is what needed to be done. We got it done. Okay. So the halfway houses was seen as a need. When you do your radiotherapy treatment, sometimes you have to do 35 cycles. You have to go back and forth because not everybody lives in the vicinity of the hospital. It's a referral center, so they're all referred from all over Malaysia. So they need to have accommodation where we needed to have the house near the hospital, and it's free, and it's for patients who need to come either on a daily basis for their treatment. You know, so they don't have to be warded. These are not, you know, patients that need to be warded.
Mm-hmm. They're day procedures.
Yes. So, but it's too far for them to go home. So, you know, that adds on to the anxiety of transport costs. And sometimes they may not be well enough to travel. So when you have a halfway house, they can recuperate 1 or 2 days. And it's, you know, within 10 kilometers or nearest is like, 2 kilometers.
How many
provide the transport as well?
How many of these houses do you currently operate?
Because there's 9 referral centers for radiotherapy. So we're on our 6th now. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be making available 9 halfway houses throughout Malaysia.
And how many patients can each house accommodate?
Well, that depends on the size of the house. Also depends on, you know, how many patients the referral center can schedule, yeah? Mm-hmm. Yes, treat. So, for example, HUKM, they can do like 35 patients in a year. So we know the cycle. So the house is usually about 10 or 15, can accommodate any one time. So we plan our halfway homes based on the referral center punya capacity.
Okay. Any other programs that you'd like to highlight?
Well, I guess, I mean, our flagship is our digital mammogram, like I said earlier, right? But we've also already set up a new unit, which is called the home care nursing. So home care nursing is a clinical team of nurses, and I think we're getting one doctor also to follow. Our pendekatan, our approach is individual, you know, care. Not everybody goes through the same, but generally, yeah. Okay, the needs are different. Okay, clinically and psychologically. So this unit would go to our patients' home, especially those in the 3rd and 4th stage, who may face a little more of a challenge of mobility. Okay, BMI is not very good, so the team would go and assess the patients in their home. So this is nationwide, countrywide. So if you live as far as, I don't know, Blengong,
yeah,
we will find, you know, make sure that the health assessment Because some are bedridden and they have bed sores, and some family members are afraid or don't know how to manage the bed sore properly. So when we go down, we will assess and teach them again and then come back and see. So that's new for us. And I think that's one of the things that we saw that we needed to help the patients.
Okay, let's go back to, like you said, Magna works by filling in the gaps to ensure that patients' cancer care and treatment is uninterrupted as much as possible. When it comes to the financial situation for people with cancer and their families, and especially as we consider cancer treatments, the advances in cancer treatments today inevitably means that cancer care also gets more expensive. What are the challenges that has presented to your resources and your ability to continue supporting the patients?
Oh my God, that's such a good question. That's about survival, Mona. Yeah. How do we survive without money, right?
Yeah.
My dad always says, no money, no talk. So fundraising has always been at the core of what we do. It's like a business. If you don't have money, if you can't make money, you can't help people. Yeah, you can only do'a. So since day one, our fundraising team has been a priority for us, because sustainability, continuity, survival. So we used to have programs that were like, you know, normal charities do dinners, golf tournaments, runs, you know, event-based. But as you know, event-based, you can't do it on a daily basis. You can't have 365 runs in a year and then expect, you know, everybody to give their hard-earned money. So what we did was, okay, let's see. How do we do this? Okay, we ask for small sum. That means and in volume. That means ask from a lot of people a small sum of money instead of asking a little bit, you know, few people for large sums of money, right? Which they are able to tell us, okay, I can give this. I can commit 6 months. I can commit 1 year, right? You can commit $10 a month, right? For a year, that's 120 ringgit. So those are kind of programs that we develop over the year. We started that in 2002 because before that, we were in the red. It was like, oh my God, we're not going to survive. That was the turning point. 2002 was a turning point. We can't be doing the programs, fundraising programs like we used to. Okay. So when we did that, when we had this fundraising program in 2002, alhamdulillah, we've been able to raise enough so that we can do more. And we needed to ensure that every service that we give is uninterrupted. Our nurses need to get paid. We can't say like, okay, bulan ni ada gaji, bulan depan tak ada gaji. We can't do that. We have about 100 nurses on our payroll. So they need, you know, professionals. We run professionally. You need to have that stability in terms of, you know, your income. We are run like a business, but we do charity work.
Have you come close to a point where, you know, you might have had to disrupt some of your services?
That's a good question as well. Because of the planning, you know, the earlier team, you know, the planning, the foresight of the president and the exco was that we needed to ensure that we could survive at least 3 years of reserves. So that's what we've been doing. So that we've been able to have a very healthy financial standing. So it's not something that it's at the back of our mind, you know, in the event, you know, we don't get people to donate. But because we can showcase or we can show to our donors that whatever 10 ringgit that they give, this is where it has ended. It's, you know, it's given treatment to patients, gives financial aid uninterrupted to patients. We give screening services. We give halfway houses. So when they see that, the trust level is high, the credibility is there. So the support, alhamdulillah, has been, you know, an average donor gives to Magna 6 years. So 6 years of their donation of 10 ringgit is quite a bit.
With the pandemic, you know, everybody's expecting a lot of financial challenges. So how will that impact your work?
Oh, yeah. It's just, because the source of funds from the fundraising program, Teddy, was face-to-face. It was largely face-to-face. You know, people give to people that you can see, right? Calling doesn't work, right? With all this scam and stuff like that. So when the pandemic hit, we had to stop all our fundraisers on the ground. Zero income was zero for 3 months. So we were running on reserves. So what happened was like, look, nothing's forever. Everything's temporary. We have to find a new way of doing things. So technology probably is another way of doing things. So now the program that has been so successful over the years is being challenged. Now we have to think, okay, how else are we? How? What way are we going to raise money now? Okay, so the team is working very hard, trying to say, like, look, what can we do? So one of the things that we've thought of, I mean, I have to share with you, this is a trade secret, yeah? We have over the years, you know, since 2002, we have a database of 300,000 donors. So that's quite a lot. Active is now 100,000. So we have 200,000 people who stopped donating for whatever reason. Yeah, it's fine. So maybe we can tap into that, you know, calling them because they know us before, mm-hmm. rather than, you know, getting new donors. So that's what we're thinking, is trying to think of diversifying our income. We were dependent on that single source, which gave us 80% of our income. So that's dangerous, right? Mm-hmm. If in a business point, very dangerous. Mm-hmm. So now we have to look, we have to diversify, you know, maybe 30-30. So if anything happens, we know we have the other two or three to back us up.
Can you paint us a picture if there was no Magna or other organizations that provide the kind of supporting services that you do? What would happen to the people living with cancer and their families?
Ayuh, takut nak jawab. Because the work that we do covers from womb to tomb, yeah? So what we've been able to do is like knitting, you know, weaving, you know, making sure that, you know, every loop is connected. That's our biggest strength. So without Magna, I guess, you know, there will be holes.
Yeah, because like you said, you are filling in major gaps. So
yeah,
those gaps will be left unattended.
Yeah.
So what are your priorities for this year and for the coming decade? Obviously, your funding, you are going to look at solutions. What are your other priorities? Especially, you know, to also encourage people to change their mindset about cancer.
Yeah, so it's a great question. I've been having this question, you know, for the past 5 years, okay? Issue right now is, even before the pandemic, it's succession. Succession, sustainability, that has been a key issue for me. The board level, the management level, right? You need to have that core group of people who believe in the same thing, who want to do the same thing, the same amount of passion, tenacity, resilience. If you have a new breed of people who's just like a la kadar, the magna that it's supposed to be will not be the same, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge issue for us as an organization to be true to our core mission, okay? People, purpose, planet. That's something which is so important. So that's why we've been now very engaged with United Nations. Now we are we receive the consultative status, you know, and UN. So it's to ensure that whatever that we do can be passed on. Yeah, we are just stewards, right? To be passed on to the next generation. But they need to make sure that, you know, it goes on just getting better and better and better. So that's one, from an organizational point of view. Now, two, what we hope, what we would like to see is that the cancer incidences go down, or at least detected much earlier. And it's a generational thing. Okay. So if I have a daughter, I could educate her earlier. So starting at the home, maybe in school. So that's why now we are in schools as young age tadika, darjah satu sampai darjah lima, because we know children have a very powerful voice in the house. Mm-hmm. So because we know it's a generational thing, so you start from there. So hopefully to get all this information out there in schools as part of mainstream biology, you know, whatever. So we would like to speak to all, you know, develop something with the Ministry of Education. Tak payah tinggi, yang sekolah rendah cukup. The other thing is now helping Malaysia is one, and we want to be helping our neighboring countries as well, low middle income countries as well. So to be a key player in the Asia Pacific region as well, because we know cancer is borderless, right? It doesn't matter where you are from, right? And the problems will be the same. So with, you know, SDG goals one, you know, no poverty. Yeah, we need to handle that as well. SDG goals three, health inequality. You know, the gaps are still there. If we can have the gaps reduced here, why not in our neighboring countries? Okay, what happens there happens, you know, it's going to affect us as well. So as human beings, that's something we aspire to. I know it's very philosophical, but you need to have that. You need to have that so that, you know, life becomes simple, it becomes clear, it becomes focused. So if anything happens, pandemic, a crisis, or whatever, you're steady.
So, Farah, this is your call to tell us how we can donate to Magna. I, for one, would certainly like to sign up to be a regular donor. And I hope, you know, we can encourage others to do the same. So tell us, how can we find out more information and how we can donate?
Okay. Our website, there's a click on donate there. But I think we'd like you to also click on the volunteer bit as well. I think that is also very crucial, you know, to get people, because the work that we do requires human touch. Funds, yes, is one. The human touch, the human element is as equal as important. So if you go to our website, www.magna.org.my, there's two pink buttons in the right-hand corner also.
All right, so that's www.magna.org.my. So hopefully we can encourage more people to either sign up to be donors or to be volunteers with your organization. Do you have a final message to share with us today, Farah?
I just probably say that with everything that's happened in the world, you know, just to find your space, to always be grateful. Live the best that you can. Make sure that whatever that you do impacts your life, fulfills your life and the people around you. And then makes the life worth living, dear.
Thank you so much. I've been speaking to Farahida Mohamad Farid, General Manager of the National Cancer Council Malaysia, or MACNA, on what it's been like to receive the Merdeka Award 2020 and what are their plans moving ahead to continue to support cancer patients in Malaysia. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.